Well, there's no question now that we're in a new COVID-19 wave and the climb is steep, but we're all still kind of in suspense over how deadly this wave is likely to turn out to be. The bad news is that the new variant, Omicron, is a lot more transmissible than earlier variants, and it's currently spreading really fast. The good news is that vaccines are likely to keep people out of the hospital, especially if they get a booster shot. The other good news is that new, highly effective antiviral drugs are going to be available really soon. One in particular, by Pfizer called Paxlovid, actually had 89% efficacy in a clinical trial against hospitalization and death, and that's taken as a pill, so it could be very simple. The big problem there will be getting enough supply. Well, those are some of the topics we'll be talking about on today's episode of Follow the Science, an exploration of science, medicine, and medical misinformation. I'm your host, Faye Flam. I'm a science journalist and a Bloomberg Opinion columnist, and this podcast grew out of an award from the Society for Professional Journalists. My guest today had just come in from a shift at the ICU when I interviewed him for this podcast. His name is Roger Sewelt. He's a critical care doctor and a pulmonologist, and he also hosts a podcast. It's a great podcast called MedCram, and it's something you'll really want to see if you are curious about how things work, because he not only explains things, he draws things in order to show how drugs affect different parts of your cells, with good effects and bad. I had talked to him about COVID-19 treatments months ago for an earlier episode of this podcast, and I learned that things have come a long way since then. He had a lot to say about some of the new up-and-coming treatments. But first, we talk about what he's seeing in the ICU.
Let's just put it this way. We've got about 13 patients in the intensive care unit and our 12-patient ICU hospital. And so it's full. It's definitely busy. And I would say maybe about four or five of those patients are COVID. And whereas maybe 5 or 6 months ago, 100% of the patients that I would see were unvaccinated, now we're seeing a mix of people who are unvaccinated and people who may have had two shots of the Pfizer or Moderna shot, but didn't get boosted, and they have immunocompromised state. So for instance, a patient we have is someone who has a history of a renal transplant. They've been on immunosuppression. They got their two shots, but they didn't get the booster, and they're in there for COVID. So those are the kind of people that we're seeing.
Wow. So it sounds like the message didn't really get out about the boosters, that people really need them.
Yeah. I mean, there was a recent tweet that I saw from Eric Topol that showed that there was a 90% reduction in mortality between those people who had two shots versus those that had the booster. Now, of course, the absolute risk reduction at that rate is pretty small, but you know, a 90% relative risk is pretty good.
Yeah, especially when there isn't much risk to getting that third shot, as far as I have heard. Well, it is kind of helpful to separate absolute risk and relative risk, but I think to keep things in perspective, the important issue is the risk-benefit ratio, and the risk of getting these shots is extremely low, while the benefit is pretty big, even if your absolute risk of dying from COVID is low. And clearly, the absolute risk is not that low for a lot of people who are either older or have certain health conditions, such as obesity, heart disease, and diabetes, which are all really common here in the U.S. Some of my earlier guests have been skeptical about boosters, but not for these high-risk people. They should get boosted, and they should be pretty careful in the meantime. So this takes us to this drug, and I want to make sure I pronounce it right. I probably won't. Paxlovid, the Pfizer drug. So is that something that you think will make a big difference for these patients? Or maybe we'll keep them from ending up in the hospital at all?
Yeah, Paxlovid is actually two medications in one, and I can never pronounce the first one, the one that's active. 89% effective at reducing hospitalization and death if given within 3 days of symptoms in patients who are at risk for having progression of their COVID-19. I think it's a game changer. The one problem that I see with it right now is, of course, that there's only about 180,000 doses available. When I say doses, I mean packages for a patient. So that's a 5-day course. And, you know, we're talking 200,000 people getting Omicron a day. They say up to even 1 million eventually once this thing hits full bore. And so we're going to have to figure out exactly who's going to get this medication, because if we can strategically implement guidelines correctly, we can really prevent a lot of the hospitalizations. And that's good for patients. It's also good for the hospitals because they'll remain open and viable to take care of other patients who don't have COVID-19. So I think it's good.
How do we decide? Do you think that there is already enough evidence to show who would benefit from this? Which types of conditions, what really put people at high risk, even if they are vaccinated?
Yeah. So people who are immunocompromised, people who have diabetes, obesity, hypertension, these are all the people that would be best served with this kind of medication. You know, there's people out there that can't get the vaccine. Either they have an allergy to it or they can get the vaccine, but we know that they're not going to get a good response. General Colin Powell, the former General Colin Powell passed away despite the fact that he had 2 shots of the vaccine. That's because he had a condition called multiple myeloma. That's a condition where the immune system really doesn't respond well in making antibodies. And so there's, you know, there's lots of people in this country that have very similar conditions and they can get the vaccine, but we know that the vaccine doesn't benefit them as well. So they would be added in as one of those patients.
Is it going to be a logistical problem to get that drug to them when they need it early? Will that mean they'll really need to be equipped with rapid tests so that they can find out ASAP when they have COVID?
Yes, in a sense, they would need to do that. I think the most important aspect is really the inclusion criteria was from the onset of symptoms, is to the first full day of symptoms is when the clock starts to click. So long as they can get a test within a day or two or three even, then they know immediately they're tested. They can call into a healthcare provider. They can go to an urgent care, go to an emergency room. They can write a prescription right there and say, you know, Paxlovid, and it's actually 3 tablets twice a day for 5 days. And here's the real kicker is, whereas before, if you wanted to set up antibodies, infusion tests, you had to get them into a facility where there was a nurse there witnessing the infusion, and the infusion took an hour. So there was a lot of resources involved. Here, it's simply a pill.
And so it sounds like some people who are at very high risk, maybe their physicians will be ready to prescribe this and they can have the home tests. They can be kind of ready to spring into action.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of preparation. If you're thinking ahead and you know what you need to do, it's better to have it on hand and have it available. I wouldn't go as far as to say as to have, you know, the actual medication there, because we don't want people hoarding it. We want it to be available. But in terms of getting the testing done and realize that this is an upper respiratory, it'll feel just like a cold. We're starting to see this more and more, that Omicron is more upper respiratory and less lower respiratory, though people can get lower respiratory symptoms. So yes.
Is there any way to know whether those people who are in the ICU now are still having Delta or whether these might be Omicron cases?
Yeah, no, unfortunately, the way that we know how much Omicron is present is at the county, at the state level, where they take random samples and they'll tell you what percent of the new cases are Omicron. And so right now where I am in California, that's about 50%. I'm sure it's probably north of that now because Omicron is quickly taking over the cases that we're seeing. Fortunately, I am not seeing a huge increase in hospitalizations. I say that with my fingers crossed here under the keyboard, but you know, sometimes it takes a little bit of time for that to show up. But if you look at South Africa, the peak has already occurred. The number of cases are coming down and hospitalizations are going down as well. Now, South Africa is not the UK. It's not the United States. It's a younger population and it's spreading amongst younger populations. So we can't compare apples to oranges there. But I think there's enough studies out now that show that there very well may be a more milder presentation of Omicron. Let's hope that bears out.
Yes, I think we're all keeping our fingers crossed for that. Are there any worrisome side effects with Paxlovid?
So So Paxlovid is very well tolerated. In fact, the medication that's in there, ritonavir, is used in HIV as a protease inhibitor and a P450 inhibitor, which blocks the metabolism of the other medications to make sure that they're higher in concentration. They use it chronically almost every day, and it's very well tolerated. And in this situation, you're just using it for 5 days. So in fact, if you look at the data that Pfizer released, there were more medicine discontinuations in the placebo arm. There were more adverse events in the placebo arm than there were in the intervention. You're like, well, how could that possibly be? How could possibly a placebo be worse tolerated than the medication? And really what it boils down to is the medication is so effective at reducing the symptoms of the disease that there are just less symptoms. And therefore, you ascribe less of those symptoms to the tablet than it would be the case in the placebo. So I think it's extremely well tolerated. And of course, this medication doesn't cause any mutations in the DNA or the RNA. So it's going to be great.
The reason he brings up the fact that this drug doesn't cause mutations in DNA or RNA is that there's another drug made by Merck that does. That drug, called molnupiravir, was the subject of a lot of hype early on because it looked really good early in clinical trials, but by the end, it only got to 30% efficacy against hospitalization and death, so really inferior to the Pfizer drug. And that part about the mutations, well, the Merck drug, molnupiravir, attacks the viral RNA by causing a lot of mutations in the virus, and that's actually how it kills the virus, but it doesn't always kill all the viral particles. And so some scientists have started worrying that the viral particles that survive could go on to become the next really bad variant. I mean, I wondered whether they should just focus on the Pfizer drug and forget the Merck drug. I've asked a couple of people that and haven't really gotten a good answer, except just that it may be the next best thing if you can't get the Pfizer drug.
Yeah, it's not all or none. It's, you know, these are two different companies with two different bandwidths, and, you know, the FDA, it doesn't take much for them to approve it. So I think the more tools you have in your tool shed, the better off you're going to be. You know, if I'm at the house and I've got something that's broken on the grounds and it's, you know, 200 feet away, I'm going to take as many tools with me so I don't have to keep walking back. And it's the same sort of thing. The more tools we have available to physicians to treat patients out there, the better we're going to be.
The conversation pretty quickly circles back around to Paxlovid, the Pfizer drug, because that's the one the doctors are really excited about since it has that 89% efficacy. And it's actually two drugs. Here he explains how they work.
Now, just to get a little bit more into the detail of the pharmacokinetics and how this works, there are two medicines actually in Paxlovid. One is the active medication that actually is what we call the protease inhibitor. What that does is it blocks the ability of the virus to chop up the proteins that it makes in a way that it can reproduce its mRNA. That's to say that part of the process of reproduction inside your cells is its functioning protease. What this medicine Paxlovid does is it inhibits that viral protein from doing that job. And so the virus can't reproduce in the body. Well, the problem is that this protease inhibitor that's part of Paxlovid gets metabolized by your body. And so the other half of the pill is ritonavir, which blocks your body's ability or slows it down to prevent that metabolism. What happens is that this medicine, this active form of the medicine, stays around in your body longer. So that's great for Paxlovid. The problem is that it also blocks some of the metabolism of other medications that you may be taking. And so what probably would have to happen is you'd have to stop taking those medications during the period of time that you're on Paxlovid and then just restart them again afterwards. But again, that's going to be in the hands of treating physicians who know their patients and what they need to be doing.
The other drug I was sort of interested in was this, I think it's called fluvoxamine, the one that was an antidepressant. So that sort of looked like, it doesn't seem like it's getting that much attention, but that actually looked pretty good in the trials, didn't it?
Yeah, so there was a trial that was done in Brazil called the Together trial, and it was a very ingenious trial. It was an adaptive platform trial, which means that as patients came in with COVID-19, they simply distributed them to different arms of their trial. In one arm of the trial, they gave them hydroxychloroquine. In another arm, they gave them ivermectin. In another one, they gave them this fluvoxamine. And what they did was they peeked in on the trials every so often to see if there was a difference in those groups. They found no difference in the hydroxychloroquine arm, and they discontinued that arm. They thought they saw something in the ivermectin arm, but after further evaluation, there was no signal. But very early on, actually, they found a difference in the fluvoxamine arm. They watched it again, and finally, they noticed that there was an endpoint. And so the Data Safety Monitoring Board stopped that part of the trial and said, really, it's not ethical for us to continue to give people placebo in this arm because we see a clear benefit with fluvoxamine. Same kind of numbers as we saw with molnupiravir, where there was about a 30% relative risk in hospitalization, which is pretty significant. So the question is why does this work?
This next part is fascinating. We talk about how this antidepressant drug helps shut down the extreme inflammation that can make COVID-19 infection so deadly. And it's something that's completely unrelated to the mechanism by which it works against depression.
We know that fluvoxamine is something called a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. It increases serotonin, and that makes people less depressed. But that has nothing to do why this medication seems to work in COVID-19. In fact, what seems to work is in the mitochondria, there is a signaling, actually in the endoplasmic reticulum of the cell, that's a component of the cell, there's a signaling that tells the nucleus to transcribe all of these pro-inflammatory cytokines. And what happens is that there's a sigma receptor, it's called the sigma 1R receptor, and it shuts this down. So in other words, stimulation of the sigma 1R receptor shuts down this inflammatory cytokine production, which is very detrimental and part of COVID-19. Well, what they found is that fluvoxamine, more than any of the other SSRIs or antidepressants, seemed to stimulate that sigma 1 receptor in a way that it tended to shut down that pro-inflammatory reaction. And so they knew this before they started the trial. That's why they wanted to test fluvoxamine in the trial. And they found that it worked very well. I mean, it's very cheap. It's been FDA approved for other indications like depression. It's used all around the world. It has a very good safety profile. It costs about $4. By the way, it costs about $4 for an entire course of the treatment, and there's a 30% reduction. Whereas with Paxlovid, that's around $530. But again, it's got an 89% reduction in hospitalization and death. So in terms of price per amount of percent, it's a little bit off. But hey, 30% is nothing to laugh at. And I think it's worthwhile looking at. Again, it's another tool that we have to treat patients who have COVID-19.
I mean, does it have an EUA at this point?
It does not. And it's still, as far as I know, it's being looked at by the World Health Organization. I would really love them to take a look at it because it's a very cheap, easy, inexpensive way of reducing the cost of hospitalization or reducing hospitalization in patients by 30%. That's not small. That's about on order of molnupiravir, which is being looked at by Merck. And with the fluvoxamine, you don't have the risk potentially of changing the DNA or the RNA having mutations.
Yeah. It seems like an obvious one to give an EUA to soon. So, I mean, what do you think is holding it up?
Not sure. You know, it was one trial. It was a big trial. I'm sure there's actually two publications. There was one in the journal Chest, which was about over a year and a half ago. And it showed that there was some preliminary positive findings. And then finally, this trial, which was done in Brazil, it was done in conjunction with McMaster University, which is a very esteemed university in Ontario, Canada, and also in conjunction with the Pontifical University in Brazil. So these are very well-renowned research entities. They did a very good study. I don't understand why it's not being looked at more. I think it should be. You know, a lot of people complain that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin were not looked at seriously because they were cheap alternatives and, you know, they wanted to follow the money. Well, here's an example where we actually have good evidence that fluvoxamine works. And I would love for, you know, the people that matter, the people that make these decisions, to show that they are also looking at this as well.
We get back to booster shots, and he had a really interesting perspective, which I think might convince a lot of people that they should get these boosters and that, no, you probably won't have to go back and get a new one every 6 months forever.
I think a lot of people in healthcare you know, this is an opinion of mine, but it's an observation, feel like if they talk about boosters, it's somehow admitting that the first two shots were somehow ineffective. And I think that might be the reason why boosters aren't pushed as much as they are, because then you hear about the third dose. Well, then what about the fourth dose, the fifth dose? And that completely misses the point that, you know, as your body sees something more and more, it's not a linear, it's not a one plus one plus one. It's like a two times two times two. It's multiplicative. As the body sees an antigen over and over again, its response is not linear, but exponential. It's going to make even more T cells. It's going to finally understand that this is an antigen that is worth spending energy and time to make pools of T cells and memory B cells for. I think there's been a little bit of that. And as a result of that, that messaging hasn't gotten out as well as it should. But clearly the data shows that for people who are immunocompromised, even people who are not immunocompromised, and it's the reason why I got the booster.
Yeah, I got mine. I told my friends to all get it. I was kind of surprised that some friends of mine who were over 70 just got it. And I'm thinking, why did you wait so long? But it is because that message hasn't been strong enough.
I agree.
So are there any other things that are really important at this juncture for people to know and for people to think about in the general public? Any other messages you'd like to see get out there?
Yeah. So real quick, again, ventilation is key. If you want to try to avoid Omicron, it's extremely infectious. So making sure that we have good ventilation. And now let's go back to the basics of good sleep, good rest, something really that I've been looking at and has really been amazing. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about it on our channel is light. It's really fascinating. There is a whole science behind infrared radiation, light. We are now finding out that melatonin. So let me just back up a little bit. We knew from the very beginning that COVID-19 hit people with metabolic problems, diabetes, hypertension, and a lot of those things have their genesis in the mitochondria of the cells. This is where hydroxy radicals and reactive oxygen species are made in metabolically deranged people. And one of the things that we're now finding out that mops those things up very, very nicely is melatonin. Now, we used to think that melatonin was made in the pineal gland only, and it was at night. That's actually just the backup system. The grand majority of melatonin is actually made in the day. It's made in the mitochondria. And the thing that stimulates melatonin production more than anything else is natural sunlight, which has a high content of infrared radiation. New emerging studies in the last few years have now started to bear this out. And so I look back at history, I look back at the 1918 pandemic, where these sanitariums were putting people outside in the sun because they found that they got better faster. And I don't have any randomized controlled trials, but I will say this, there was a study that was published in Scotland where they looked in the United States last winter and they compared mortality with latitude. And there was this very strong correlation between higher north latitude equaled higher mortality rates after they controlled for age and all of the demographics and the things that you can imagine. But here's the kicker. People would say, well, that's just vitamin D. This was at such a high latitude. They only looked at people in the northern latitudes that it was so far north that the scientists concluded that there was no way enough vitamin D could have been made at that altitude, at that latitude, at that time in the winter. There must be something about sunlight that is doing something to the body outside of the mechanism of vitamin D. So I think that's exciting to me. So to getting as much natural light as you possibly can and getting that infrared light, that's something that's really easy to do. It's not expensive. It's accessible to just about everybody. And so I think that's something that we ought to look into.
You mean you can get it if you live in a place like the northeastern United States, New England, at the beginning of winter? How do you get that light?
So here's the thing. It's got to be infrared light because that's what stimulates the cytochrome C oxidase in the mitochondria to produce the melatonin. We find that when you look at light and the sun, we're used to thinking about vitamin D and ultraviolet radiation. And that's best when the sun is the highest and the brightest in the sky, something that never really happens in the Northeast in the wintertime. That's not when you get infrared radiation. Infrared radiation actually happens at that time, but you can get it much earlier. As the sun is rising, you get plenty of infrared radiation. So the point here I want to make is that if you think that you can get all of the benefit from the sunlight by taking a vitamin D capsule, I think what the science is starting to say is that's wrong. What I would say is if you have the ability to get outside into the sun, I think it's good for not only your circadian rhythm, but there is emerging evidence that it may be good for melatonin production right in the area where you need it.
Wow. And do you have to have a lot of skin exposed to the sun like you do to get vitamin D?
Yeah. So here's the good news. The good news is that infrared radiation can penetrate through your clothes into your skin.
Well, after this discussion, I started wondering what are the nuts and bolts of the way drugs affect our cells have to do with medical misinformation? It turns out everything. They have everything to do with it because this discussion is a good example of real information. Instead of expecting us to trust him, Dr. Sewelt explains in detail which drugs show promise and why, how they did in clinical trials, exactly how they were tested, and how they actually affect our cellular machinery. It's really a curiosity-driven approach, and I think curiosity is the cure for medical misinformation. Why be curious about the mitochondria and the endoplasmic reticulum? Well, because they are the working parts of your cells. They're what make you alive. In an earlier interview, he told me he was actually temporarily censored by YouTube for talking about hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. He didn't dismiss those drugs out of hand, but gave them a fair look. And I think that's the right approach. Censoring discussion was counterproductive. And if you watch MedCram, he can show you, not just tell you, but show you why those drugs, hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, are very unlikely to prevent you from getting COVID-19, and why the vaccines are likely to, at the very least, prevent you from being hospitalized, and why they might even save your life.
Thank you for listening to Follow the Science. Follow the Science is produced by Faye Flam. You can follow Faye on Twitter at Faye Flam. That is FayeFlam. Today's episode was edited by Seth Glicksman, with music by Kyle Imperator. If you liked today's episode, we'd really love it if you left us a positive rating and review wherever you listened. Thanks in advance, and we'll see you next week.